Well, good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, at our last class, we saw the unfolding of those events following David's sin. And as the record portrayed it, it brought Absalom right into the very forefront of those events as they began. And as Nathan had said, evil shall arise out of your own house, David, and it wasn't long before deceit and adultery and murder and division and hatred and strife was surrounding the palace and David's life and all those around him. We know that his oldest sons particularly had been significantly impacted during that period of his life, and they grew up unrestrained and godless young men, and they dominate the next 12 to 15 years of history from that time. Let's just have a look at this slide again. We had it up last time, but it just gives us a little bit of an indication of the timing of some of these events and the approximate age of David. At the time of Amnon's incident, David would have been around about 50. These are approximate numbers. And Absalom only in his late teens. But we know that there was this two-year wait before Absalom moved to murder his brother. That Absalom then flees and is in Geshur, where his mother's family was, for another 3 years. Then he comes back, he returns home, and there was this period of 2 years when David refused to see him. And that's where we're going to take up the story, because finally he does get to see his father after he has forced his way in. And the picture that we actually have of Absalom through all of those events, and this is Absalom just starting to come into the record, but the picture we have of him is not only of a bold young man, and remember that by this stage he's, by the time David sees Absalom, he's in his mid-twenties. He's egotistical, he's forceful, he's arrogant, he's bold, he's unrepentant. There's not much good that anyone could ever say about this young man. And what happens in chapter 14 and verse 33, when he finally gets to see David, Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. That's all it tells us about that meeting. There are no words passed, though I'm sure there were some words passed, but the record doesn't record anything about that. And as Brother Harry Tennant once said in a beautiful little summary of that state, in comes Absalom into the presence of the king, having gained every advantage and having lost nothing through that whole period. He's in his mid-twenties. David has missed an opportunity to discipline his son and to straighten his character, but Absalom did not miss a single beat. Absalom had none of the spirit of his father, and even though his father had a great love for Absalom, Absalom reciprocated none of that in this period of his life. And Absalom did not let the grass grow under his feet. And it's evident that as soon as he had been received back into favour, so to speak, even though he really probably wasn't even on speaking terms particularly with David, he had no interest whatever in actually speaking to his father. He had other things in his head. And all he wanted was the status of a prince back again, so that what would flow was influence and money into his pocket. And it's clear as we start chapter 15 that that's exactly what had happened as a result of him coming back and meeting David again. It came to pass, verse 1, after this, after he'd been received back by David, that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. He immediately instituted a marketing campaign. He had influence now, and he had money at his disposal from the, presumably from the royal coffers. And he immediately organized things. He wasn't going to sit down and just let nothing happen. And the very first thing he did was start to show everyone his authority and who he was. He was a prince in the kingdom, and he was going to tell everyone who he was. And in fact, make it very clear that he wanted the throne. Amazing, isn't it? That this is just nothing like David. David never, ever, ever sought to promote himself by things like Absalom's doing here in verse 1. This man is so far from David, it's unbelievable that he was actually his son. Though he may possibly have even been good-looking like David, he's nothing like him at all. David's appeal was never to get chariots and horses and people who could run before him and announce him and have him paraded where everyone could see him. David shied from all that in the true spirit of godliness and humility that he had. But his son was exactly the opposite. And he was not only an ungodly man, he was determined to use every moment. Look at verse 2. And Absalom rose up early and stood by the way in the gate. He was going to let nothing get in his way. You know, as Jesus later said, the children of this world are wiser in their generation, aren't they? Often those who are pursuing their own evil ends can get up early when the saints can't. But Absalom understood that the power of personal interest was going to get him where he wanted. And if he could only get himself into the hearts of the people, then he would be able to go somewhere. He wasn't interested in the people at any time. He was never interested in the people. He was only ever interested in himself. And that, in the end, was his huge downfall. He came to his end simply because Absalom was only ever interested in Absalom. And so we find in verse 2 that he rose up early and stood in the way of the gate, and it was so that when any man had a controversy, came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called to him and said, "Of what city are you?" You know, engaged them in conversation. And Absalom said unto him, "Oh, see, thy matters are good and right, and there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee." Moreover, he said in verse 4, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and every man had a suit would come to me, and I would do him justice." It's just what everyone wanted to hear. It's just pandering to the flesh. This man was no fool in that sense. He actually understood. He set himself in a prominent position right in the gate where the king would actually normally hear things. And he intercepted those who had grievances. Oh, if you catch people who've got grievances, brothers and sisters, you've got a captive audience. And even more so, if you can not only show interest in what they're saying, but if you can agree with their cause, which is what he did, and then put himself in, "If I was the judge, then everything we find, and I would do this for you," and I would, a typical politician, offering the world and really not caring for anyone else but himself. But it's strange, isn't it, that it doesn't seem that David was there in the gate, because how could this all be happening? If Absalom's doing all this and telling all these people these things, and David's there sitting in the gate and these people are getting intercepted, it just appears that David, for some reason, wasn't actually in the gate. Or not as often as he perhaps had at one stage been dispensing judgment and justice. And there's been lots of reasons for that. Possibly because of the activities of state, but that's unlikely. I think David would have been there if he could possibly have been. Just come over to Psalm 39, because there are a few hints in the Psalms that David, through this, around about this time, himself had been sick. And it may well have been that David was out of action because of his own illness, which was life-threatening, so it appears, from a few quick references. We don't spend a lot of time on this, but you know, this adds another dimension to this whole period, brothers and sisters. It's not just that David was sick. Consider, and it's to the villainy and the wickedness of what was going on in Absalom's heart. In Psalm 39, verse 11, it said, "When thou with rebukes dost correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. Surely every man is vanity. Hear my prayer, O Yahweh, give ear to my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner as all my fathers were. O spare me that I may recover strength before I go hence and be no more." Now, it's not absolutely essential that those words are talking about an illness that he had, but you read on in Psalm 40. And Psalm 39, 40 and 41 are probably set in the Absalom period. It's in this, these Psalms are set in this time period. Verse 1 of Psalm 40. "I waited patiently for Yahweh. He inclined unto me and heard my cry. He brought me up also out of an horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock and established my goings." And about the same time as that was all going on, just turn the page in verse 14. This is what was happening. Verse 14. "Let them be ashamed and confounded together that seek after my soul to destroy it. Let them be driven backward and put to shame that wish me evil." So it's at a time when these got great opposition. But perhaps Psalm 41 is even clearer, verse 3 of Psalm 41. "Yahweh will strengthen him upon a bed of languishing." Let's read verse 2. "Yahweh will preserve him and keep him alive. He shall be blessed upon the earth, and thou wilt not deliver him unto the will of his enemies. Yahweh will strengthen him upon the bed of languishing. Thou wilt make all his bed in his sickness." Verse 5, "Mine enemies speak evil of me. When shall he die and his name perish?" You see, it appears that David was actually sick and possibly even thought to be dying. Verse 6, "And if he come to see me, he speaketh vanity." This is talking about his enemies. "His heart gathereth iniquity to itself, and when he goeth abroad, he telleth it. All that hate me whisper together against me. Against me do they devise my hurt. An evil disease, say they, cleaveth fast unto him. And now that he lieth, he shall rise up no more." That's what some of those in Absalom's camp were actually saying. So it may well have been that just through this period where Absalom is building his power base, that David himself is really not prominent because he's not well. In the midst of his own personal health calamity, Absalom capitalizes on this and shames David for lack of action and promotes himself in the eyes of the people. It's just a form of wickedness, isn't it? Verse 5, and we read it, "It was so that when any man came," this is back in 2 Samuel 15 now, verse 5, "and it was so that when any man came nigh to him to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand and took him and kissed him." All this false modesty and palaver that was going on there at the gate. "And in this manner," says the record in verse 6, "did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment." He intercepted those who were coming to see David. And so he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Isn't that a terrible, terrible little phrase? He stole the hearts. His policy had succeeded. You know, this wasn't an honest transaction at all. You know, when you steal something, brothers and sisters, it belongs to someone else. And the hearts of Israel belonged to David. God had given them to David. They rightly belonged to David because of all that David had done as a man of God's own, after God's own heart. And this man, his own son, had come in and deceitfully and on false pretenses, sneakily, had actually stolen the hearts, slowly stolen the hearts. And herein lies one of the greatest sins of Absalom. You remember David's attachment to his people? He risked his life time after time after time for those little sheep of his pasture. That's how David saw them. And now these little ones had been stolen by someone else. Remember what Jesus said about that many years later? "Woe, woe to that man." that makes one of these little ones stumble. That's exactly what Absalom had done. He had caused all these little ones of David, that David had protected for years and years and had inspired them with positive and spiritual things. Now his son comes in full of himself and steals them away. Better, said Jesus, was that a millstone be hanged around his neck than that he make one of these little ones to stumble. But as if that wasn't enough, verse 7 goes on, came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto Yahweh in Hebron. Some versions actually have 4 years, which seems much more reasonable. If it's 40 years, it's very difficult to know where that 40-year period starts, and it doesn't really seem to have much relevance if it's 40 years. And I think it's the Septuagint and Syriac Hebrew version actually have 4 years there instead, which does make a lot more sense. And it's this, I think this is probably what it's talking about, this 4 years from the time that he became a prince. That is, again, he was reinstated with the status of a prince once he had actually seen David again. And so all of these events are happening in this 4 years. He is certainly not standing still through this whole period. So he comes to David and says, at the end of this 4 years, and says, I pray let me go to Hebron because I've vowed a vow unto Yahweh. I made this vow when I was in Geshur and I want to now keep it. See what he says in verse 8? Thy servant vowed a vow while in Geshur in Syria, saying, if Yahweh shall bring me again, I will serve Yahweh. You know, he'd had 4 years to prove that. In fact, he had longer than that because he'd been back in the nation, in Jerusalem, here for 6 years now. Because this is where he's coming to David, up here at the end of this four-year period, and saying to David, look, I made this vow 6 years ago. I'd like to now go and fulfill that. Well, if you'd made a vow that you're going to serve Yahweh when you come back, and you came back 6 years before, surely we would have seen some evidence of him, of his service to Yahweh. But what do we see? Intrigue, hatred of his father, undermining of everything, just trying to bolster his own ego. Unbelievable. And David says, verse 9, go in peace. You know, I think Absalom knew that his father would say that because he got to David's heart by saying, oh, look, I'm turning around, I've vowed a vow to actually serve Yahweh. And it was music to David's ears in a sense. He wanted to hear that his sons were wanting to serve Yahweh. But it was all just hypocrisy and lies. Absalom wasn't interested in serving Yahweh. He hadn't shown any interest in doing that. This was an act of religious hypocrisy amounting to profanity, one writer says. And it illustrates how well he'd actually deceived his father and how he'd used what he knew about his father, the earnest sincerity and his godliness, to actually get his own way. This was an amazing little thing on Absalom's part. You know, in many ways, Absalom was a fool, but in some ways, fools can be very smart. They can be very crafty, very wise in their own conceits. And here he chooses Hebron. Very interesting to choose Hebron. You know, Hebron was soaked in history, wasn't it? And so if he says, I want to go down and perform my vow at Hebron, to David, Hebron meant so much. And he knew that it would mean so much. Absalom knew what Hebron stood for. And he was going to use it for his own ends, deceive his father and get his own way, and eventually with the intent of killing his father and taking the throne. Unbelievable. But he goes down there because that's where the patriarchs had finally come to rest. That's where David had first reigned as king. That's where Absalom himself had been born. So there's good reasons why he might go back to his spiritual roots, so to speak. If he's now telling David that he's wanting to pay a vow, that he's going to serve Yahweh. But you know what? Hebron was just far enough away from Jerusalem to allow him to craftily do everything that he wanted to do without the palace really knowing, but also just close enough so that when his evil plan was finally hatched, he could move quickly and move into Jerusalem. You know, you think, how did David not know? David had all sorts of networks, and his intelligence was amazing. And it may well be because of his illness that we find David's really not informed and not really up with what's going on. And he's just been deceived by his own son. And Absalom puts all sorts of other things in place, you know. He gets all these spies out in the land quietly and brings 200 men down with him. And then his prime ally, he calls Ahithophel the Gilonite. Now come back to Ahithophel. Not tonight. Next class, God willing. But he gets Ahithophel on his side. Clearly, he must already have known where Ahithophel's sympathies were. This wasn't a thing of the moment. Absalom was intriguing all over the place and finding out what people thought. But his success was extraordinary, to say the least, even though it grates on us to read this. Because we read in verse 12 that Absalom calls Ahithophel while he's offering sacrifices, and the end of that verse it says, "And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom." It's almost unthinkable, isn't it, brothers and sisters, that a man, young man like this, could do this to his father, and to not just any father, to a man like David. Well, you think, why is the nation so fickle? Why didn't they see through Absalom? Well, there was the matter of Uriah that some people in the nation hadn't forgotten. It impaired David's respect to some degree and his affection in the hearts of some. But I don't think that's the only answer. It might have been that David had been ill and therefore was not visible in government, in the city, so that when people did go up, they couldn't see him. That may have been a factor. But David is also now, probably at this stage, you can see here, in his 60s, early 60s. He's now not the young warrior that he used to be, though he still had some prowess and still had an incredible ability to do anything, basically, from a military point of view. But the other thing that had happened, brothers and sisters, is a generation had risen up that hadn't known of David's early exploits, or nor of his enormous popularity. That was just stories to them. And it's almost certain that Absalom appealed to that generation. And it spread from then. Once that force had started going out, the mass media of the time, basically through word of mouth, infiltrated the people. And we find a conspiracy that was growing every day. It's just hard to imagine that people would turn against David just like that. Let's come over to Psalm 35 for a moment. Because this is what we read in, and again, Psalm 35 is one of those psalms that I haven't got time to prove any of this, but Psalm 35 is one of those psalms from this period, or it's very likely to be from this period. And in verse 4, he says, David writing this, he's asking God, verse 1, to plead my cause, O Yahweh, with them that strive against me. Fight against them that fight against me. Because he's God, all those who are coming against him. Verse 4, let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul, my life. There were people after his life, brethren and sisters. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt. Verse 7, for without cause have they hid for me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul. It's a very sad thing, isn't it, that David is in this situation. Verse 11. False witnesses did rise up. They laid to my charge things that I knew not. They rewarded me evil for good to the spoiling of my life. It's a very, very heart-wrenching psalm, isn't it, as David lays out just how he felt at this time. But read on. But as for me, he says, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth, and I humbled myself with fasting, and my prayer returned into my own bosom. I behaved myself as though he had been of my friend or brother. I bowed down heavily as one that mourneth for his mother. In mine adversity, however, they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. Yea, the abjects gathered themselves together against me, and I knew it not. They did tear me and cease not. With hypocritical mockers in feast, they gnashed upon me with their teeth. You can see where David's mind is. All his life, he'd been concerned about these little sheep. When someone was sick, he clothed himself in sackcloth and showed them compassion and did what he could. But in his adversity, all they did in return was to rejoice and gather themselves and whisper and make plans to get rid of him. You know, the people, what happened in this period, brethren and sisters, to David when you put all the Psalms together? Because it shows what David was thinking and what he was feeling at the time. This is how those who were in this conspiracy that was strong are described. They're described as the wicked, as the proud, deceitful, lying, vain, violent, bitter. That was David's experience. As this conspiracy started to grow stronger and stronger, and the nation turned against their king. And let's come back to Samuel. 2 Samuel 15, verse 13. And at this point there came a messenger to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom. Can you imagine what that meant to David? I'm going to give you a little homework tonight. I'll put it on the screen and I'll email it around. But to get a feel for what David himself was going through, there are dozens of psalms. In fact, there's at least 25 psalms in this period. That it was one of the most prolific periods of psalm writing in David's career. But here David learns that the people have revolted, that he learns of his own son's villainy and hypocrisy when he thinks that he's actually gone to Hebron to consummate his vow to serve Yahweh. And he now finds that there's a heartless cruelty in the heart of that boy. He's not only interested in the throne, he's actually interested in knifing David to get there. And not only that, all the people's hearts are with Absalom. With Absalom. Why would the people? Maybe the people might revolt. Maybe they might turn against him. But why go after Absalom? Why? What was there in Absalom? If this is what his heart was like. You can imagine what that did to David. Just put a knife straight through him. And verse 14 says, and David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword. That's entirely remarkable, brothers and sisters. Absalom is a 25-year-old inexperienced warrior. He knows nothing about the hardships of life. He knows nothing about battle. David is a seasoned general that has basically subdued the world of his time by his military prowess. And he hears that this young man his own son is going to come against him because people are saying that the hearts of the people are after Absalom. And David says, let us flee. We shan't escape from Absalom. He makes no attempt to verify whether the intelligence was right. He doesn't call a council of his generals, and he had generals there with him. He made no preparations to counter that rebellion. He made no attempt to set a siege so that he might be able to defend the city. He does none of that. He just says, we're leaving. And here is the great, valiant man, the warrior general, the king, who never backed down on any occasion in the face of evil men when they came to threaten his people in the past. David had never, ever, ever shied away. If it meant his life was on the line, he'd put his life on the line every time. And he backed away. And David looks as though he's lost his nerve. David was afraid. He wasn't afraid of Absalom. He wasn't afraid of men that would come with Absalom. He was afraid of the word of Yahweh. Because through Nathan, God had come and said, David, evil is going to arise out of your own house, and the sword is never going to depart. And as soon as he heard Absalom was after the throne, and he was coming with armies towards Jerusalem, he said, let us depart. He could fight against men, but he wouldn't fight against God. Because he knew that this whole calamity, which was swirling around him and distressing him greatly, was all because of his own sin. So he left his beloved city. Imagine how hard that was for David. It was his heart's desire to bring the ark to Zion, to take Zion first and then to bring the ark, to make a place where God could dwell, because God had said that was the place he wanted to dwell. And now he's leaving the presence of God. That was just wrenching for David. We get a bit of a difficult, an insight, a glimpse, a couple of glimpses, in fact, as we go through this record. We'll look at them in a minute, of how difficult that was actually for David to do. But what was more powerful in David's mind than the fact that he wanted to stay there and defend the palace and he wanted to be where God was that he was compliant to God's will. He'd learned through all his experiences, both before his sin and after, he'd learned that God's way is best. And he'd learned to trust. You know, brothers and sisters, we can talk about trust. But if we want to know what trust really is, we need to go to David's life and see just the cost of trusting. You know, brothers and sisters, from this moment on in this chapter, we see interwoven through the record the spirit of Christ in an utterly remarkable way. This is one of the most amazing chapters in David's life, I think, because it's one that affected our Lord Jesus Christ deeply and which he drew on in his last hours. Because you remember, if we think about it, that as the hatred and the deception and the evil and the villainous wickedness of the rulers began to grow in Jerusalem to the point where they were prepared to put him to death, Jesus left the city. He told Peter to put the sword away. He said, if my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, but it's not the time, and we're not fighting. Arise, let us flee. And he put everything in the Father's hands. You know, brothers and sisters, there's no question that Jesus' mind was back here with David at the time that he left Jerusalem on that last night and went outside the city walls. See, look at verse 15. The king's servant said unto the king, "Behold, thy servants are ready to do whatever thy lord the king shall appoint." You know, that in itself was a remarkable thing for them to say, because you would have thought they would have, you know, argued with him, but no. They were ready to do whatever. They were ready to be loyal to death. You know, you remember Jesus in the upper room is telling them, and on the way through the city, he's telling them about what's going to happen. And Peter says, you know, "I'll lay down my life for your sake." And they all said the same thing. "I'm ready to go to prison and or to death. You know, our loyalty is so great, we will be with you always." And they followed through and went with him out of the city until the pressure really got on, and then most of them couldn't handle it. But here, the king's servants are saying the same thing. And verse 16 says, "And the king went forth, and his household after him." Verse 17, "And the king went forth, and the people after him." Repeated twice. And they come in verse 17, it says, "And they tarried in a place that was afar off." In fact, the NIV says, "They halted at the last house." This was a painful exercise for David, because he's going forth and all the people are going with him, and he halted just when he got to the edge of the city. He didn't really want to go out of that city, but he knew Absalom would soon be there. And so he left, and others followed him. And 1,000 years later, his greater son, reluctant to leave the beauty of the atmosphere in the upper room, hesitated, then left, because he too knew that Judas would soon be coming back. Can you hold your hand in Samuel and go to John 18? In fact, if you've got three hands, you could use them tonight. You might use a pencil or something in, but John 18, just hold John 18 just for a moment, and we're going to also go to Luke in a second as well, and you'll still need 2 Samuel 15. Okay, so what it says in 2 Samuel 15, verse 16 and 17, is the king went forth and his household, and went forth and the people after him, right? Come to John 18, verse 1. "When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth," oh, "with his disciples." So it's exactly what's happened over here in Samuel. The king went forth and his household and his people. So here they are. And it tells us in the record that he entered with his disciples. It goes on to say, he passed over the brook Kidron, where was a garden, into which he entered and his disciples. You know, that's exactly what happened to David. And do you notice there's something very strange about the way this record is written, both in 2 Samuel and in John 18? Because it doesn't actually put them together. You know, have you got your third hand? Let's go to Luke 22. Because here is an interesting phrase, again, that picks up the same overtones from 2 Samuel 15. Luke 22, verse 39. "And he came out and went." That's a strange thing to say, isn't it? It is picking up the thought from back in 2 Samuel. "As he was wont, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him." So in both John and Luke, and back in 2 Samuel, we find that David and Jesus are actually separated, but together with those who are following them. They're actually mentioned differently. In fact, it says, remember, in John, it says, into which Jesus entered and his disciples. That's a very funny way of saying it. Why didn't it say they went into the garden? Why does it say he entered and his disciples? Why does it say he went out and his disciples came? Why didn't it say the whole company went? You know, I think the record is actually trying to tell us something here, brothers and sisters. And it's laboured emphasis because of what was going on back in 2 Samuel and is also being picked up in Luke and John. Let's just have a look at it again over in 2 Samuel 15. We just read verse 16 and 17, where we've got the king going forth and his household, or the people. But come to verse 23. "And all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people passed over. The king also himself passed over the brook Kedron, and all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness. Why didn't it say the whole company passed over? It would have been a lot easier. It saved a lot of words. But it's telling us over and over again that the king himself passed over and all the people passed over. Yes, they all went the same way, but there's something different about the king and the people. And exactly the same thing happens in the gospel records, where Jesus, going off and out of the city, is being mentioned separately, even though he's going with his disciples. You know, I think it's telling us, brethren and sisters, that though the people were there with him, in fact, the king, in David's case, and Jesus, in the case of the gospel record, were passing over on their own, even though there were people there. He was alone. David, when he left that city, brethren and sisters, and passed out of the city walls and down into the brook Kedron and passed over Mount Olivet and went on his way, David himself, while he had others with him, David was on this journey by himself. And exactly the same thing happened with our Lord. He went out of that upper room, down to the brook Kedron, across it, and into the Garden of Gethsemane, and he entered, and his disciples came. Now, it's emphasized that we're meant to see that point, because when he got into the Garden of Gethsemane, you know the very first thing that Jesus did? He said, "Now wait here while I go ahead and pray." And he took three disciples and went ahead, and he said to them, "Wait here and watch for me," and he went ahead. And he himself was alone, but with them. You know, that even came from 2 Samuel 15. Amazing. Because David here is on a journey that no one else is on. And Jesus was on a journey that none of his disciples were on, even though they were with him. Now, I suppose I'll let you let go of those things. Can you hold them a bit longer? Can you hold Luke and John a little longer? I'm finding it very difficult here. Have I got something to put in there? Because I want you to go to Psalm 69. Psalm 69 is actually one of the psalms of this whole period. It's one of the psalms that David had written around this period. It tells us about how he was feeling and some of the circumstances that were attached to that. Psalm 69, let's look at verse 2. This is what David was feeling like. He says, "I sink in deep mire where there is no standing. I am come into deep waters where the floods overflow me. I am weary of my crying. My throat is dried. My eyes fail while I wait for my God. They that hate me without cause are more than the hairs of my head." This is an intense experience for him. And not all of his servants are going through this. Verse 17. "Hide not thy face from thy servant, for I am in trouble. Hear me speedily. Draw nigh to my soul and redeem it. Deliver me because of mine enemies. Thou hast known mine reproach and my shame and my dishonour. Mine adversaries are all before thee. Reproach hath broken my heart. I am full of heaviness." We know, brothers and sisters, those words very well, because it's an amazing messianic psalm that's talking about the experience that Jesus had. But it was written by David in the midst of the extremity of this situation. And when he left that city, brethren and sisters, it was David going out and the people coming after him. They didn't understand the depth of his grief. They didn't have the load on his shoulders. They didn't understand his emotion. They didn't understand the spirit of that man. They didn't understand why he just got up and left and not fight. And it was the same with the disciples. When Jesus left and went to the garden that night, they didn't understand. We know they didn't, because they all fell asleep. Jesus is telling them he's in great trouble. He's got enormous anguish of spirit, and he can barely hold himself together, and he wants them to watch for him, and they all fall asleep. They didn't understand. They weren't on the same journey. They physically went, but they weren't on the same journey. You know, isn't it utterly amazing that in 2 Samuel 15, all of that is mirrored. This experience of Messiah is mirrored right in David's experience here. That the king himself is passing over, and everyone else is going there too. And only David has experienced the intensity of that. You know, amazing parallel with our Lord. You know, when they left the upper room and they descended into that valley, his disciples didn't understand, as we said before. They didn't understand his purpose. They didn't understand where he was going. They didn't understand his spirit. And when he got into the garden, he was alone with his God. And here, David, by his experience, is foreshadowing the experiences of Messiah. He has chosen not to resist evil, but to trust God instead. He's chosen to leave the city because of the evil that's afoot that are seeking his life. He takes his close companions who don't understand, and he goes on a journey, as 2 Samuel 15 says, toward the way, verse 23, toward the way of the wilderness. He's alone. You know, the story doesn't stop there, because as we read verse 23 a moment ago, and let's just read it again and catch something that's there. All the country wept with a loud voice, and the people passed over. The king also himself passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over towards the way of the wilderness. He passed over the brook Kidron. We just read straight over that, brothers and sisters. It was the little brook on the east of Jerusalem. But you know what? It's the very first time the brook Kedron's mentioned in the Old Testament. The very first time it's mentioned. And Kedron, if you look at every reference to Kedron in the Old Testament, you'll find this, that it marked the boundaries of the city. It was the point which, when you went over, you were out of the city. You were leaving that. And Jesus was not leaving that. David wasn't leaving that willingly here. He'd gotten to the point where he was at the boundary of the city. You remember that's what they did when the good kings later destroyed all the idolatry. They carted it out of the temple and they went and they dumped it in the brook Kedron. That was outside the city wall, outside the limits of the city. That's where they crushed it and ground it to powder. But we know that Jesus left. You've still got John, John 18. Let's read it again, verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kedron. Do you know, brothers and sisters, that is the only time in the New Testament that brook Kedron is mentioned. Unbelievable. That is telling us, the Spirit is telling us, that we've got to go back to find out where the brook Kedron is actually mentioned. And when we go back, what we do is we find that here the divine penman is highlighting this link with David in the past, who passed over the brook Kedron. He passed over the extent of the city and went out of that city. He had been rejected and he was leaving the city, just like Jesus passed over the not only out of the walls but over the boundary, and now he's outside. He's been rejected by the people. And he's following the footsteps of David, his father in the past. But look what happens in verse 30, back in Samuel. David went up by the ascent of Mount Olivet and wept as he went up and had his head covered, and he went barefoot, a symbol of humiliation. And all the people that were with him covered every man his head, and they went up and they were weeping too as they went up. David went over the brook and up the Mount of Olives. You know, there's only twice that the Mount of Olives is actually mentioned in the Old Testament. You know where they are? Here, this chapter, and one more. Anyone tell me where it is? Zechariah 14. And that's in the future, talking about what's going to happen to the Mount of Olives in the future. So there's one reference in the Old Testament, and only one reference about the Mount of Olives. And it's here. And you know, brothers and sisters, That's exactly where Jesus was headed on that night that he went out of the city. Every one of the Synoptic Gospels says that Jesus went out to the Mount of Olives. And only one of them actually mentions it as a garden, and only one of them says it was Gethsemane. But they all say he went out to the Mount of Olives. Why does it say that? Well, why did they go out there? Why did Jesus go out to the Mount of Olives? Have you still got Luke 22? I've just lost it, but I'm going to find it again. Luke 22, verse 39. And he came out and went as he was wont to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. He went out as he was wont. That is, he went out as he usually did. This was some place. And verse 40 says, and when he was at the place, he said unto them, pray that ye enter not into temptation. So he's going out to the place that he usually goes to. It's called the Mount of Olives. And when he gets there, we find everything that's told us is what happened in Gethsemane. So the place he got to was Gethsemane. That was out to the Mount of Olives. It was at the base of the Mount of Olives. So he crossed over the brook Kidron and came to the place on the Mount of Olives, which was Gethsemane. So this was a special place where Jesus went to pray and to worship. You know, it's amazing that if you ever notice, just turn back a page to Luke, in Luke, this is, Luke 21 and verse 37. It says, after he'd given the Olivet prophecy, it says, in the daytime he was teaching in the temple, and at night he went out and abode in the mount that is called the Mount of Olives. Have you ever wondered what he did? I think I never really thought about that until fairly recently. He went out and abode in the mount that's called the Mount of Olives. I have absolutely no doubt that Jesus went to Gethsemane. And he stayed in Gethsemane that night, all night, in prayer. And then, just shortly after that, when it comes to the last night of his life, he takes his disciples again out to the Mount of Olives, which is this special place where he goes. Well, come back to 2 Samuel for a moment. Because we're told in verse 32 that it came to pass that when David was come up to the top of the mount where he worshipped God, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him. Well, let's just go back there, because this little phrase here, was come to the top of the mount where he worshipped God. The RV says, or the RV margin says, where he was wont to worship, implying that this had been a place where David had often worshipped. So on the Mount of Olives, it appears that there was a place where David himself had that was special that he went. Isn't that amazing? Because Jesus actually had a place at the Mount of Olives that he went and took his disciples out. And so now we find, on this occasion when David is leaving the city because of the rejection of the people, and because of the mounting evil, he's going out across the brook Kedron like Jesus did. He's going across that unto the Mount of Olives, just like Jesus did later. Quite amazing, isn't it? And as he went, he wept. We read in verse 30, weeping as he went up. Well, we know that Jesus' experience was just the same, because in Hebrews 5, verse 7, it says, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, he was heard by all that. Parallels with David's experience and the Lord's are absolutely remarkable. You know, their path, brothers and sisters, the reasons for them going, their emotions. This was David's experience of Gethsemane. He went through Gethsemane. And Jesus later, looking back on that, was to draw strength from that. You know, it wasn't just that it was in the same location, but it was because of what happened there. Now, are you back in 2 Samuel 15? Because verse 23 says, as we read, he went over the brook Kedron. Verse 30 says, he ascended the Mount of Olives, and he comes to the top of the mount. So somewhere in between verse 23 and verse 30, Jesus has passed over the brook, and he's going up the Mount of Olives. And then he gets to the top of the Mount of Olives. And somewhere between the brook of Kedron and the top of Mount Olives is Gethsemane. And there was a little incident that happens in verse 24 to 29. Zadok comes with the priests, and they're bearing the ark. And they wait till all the people come out. And the king comes in verse 25, and he says unto Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city, If I shall find favour in the eyes of Yahweh, he shall bring me again and show both me, show me both it and his habitation. But if he does say, I have no delight in thee, behold, here am I, let him do to me as seemeth good unto him. You know, brothers and sisters, that is an utterly remarkable thing. If you have a look at this, what David is saying here, in the very location of Gethsemane, between the brook Kedron and the top of the mount, see, he's in the region of Gethsemane. He says, if I shall find favour, but if not, let God do to me as it seemeth good to him. And 1,000 years later, his greatest son came into exactly the same region for exactly the same reason. And he said, if thou be willing, but if not, not my will but thine be done. In the very same location, for the very same reasons, David's spirit foreshadowed the spirit of Messiah. This was David's Gethsemane, and he laid the foundation for Messiah to read and to be inspired. You know, from this whole period, as I said before, there's a list, and you can get that, copy that. Like, they're just some of the parallels. That's only the start of the parallels, a few of which we've looked at between David and Christ coming through this region. But there's a list of all the Absalom-era psalms, and they are utterly amazing. And you know, you find those psalms in the mouth of Jesus in the last days of his ministry. You find them in his mouth on the cross in Gethsemane and describing David, the Messiah's whole experience. So Jesus was sent back to this period of David's life and given inspiration to walk the path that he was going to have to go in order to get to the cross. You know, we might ask ourselves, you know, why? Why did David have to walk this, and why did Jesus have to go through this Gethsemane experience? What does Gethsemane really stand for? And in David's life, it's exactly the same as it is in our Lord's. You know, what Gethsemane reveals, brothers and sisters, is that there, in that place, given the experiences that were before them, both David and Jesus revealed their absolute surrender to the will of God. And from their lips was wrung the words, through all their sufferings that experienced, not my will, but thine be done. And they weren't just words, brothers and sisters. They weren't just words in the mouth of David either. We know they weren't just words in the mouth of our Lord. But they weren't just words in the mouth of David. We find these words wrung out of David in agony, when he's come to realise in an absolute sense the only thing he wants to ever do is the will of God. He doesn't want his own will. He doesn't want it anymore. And there, in that very place, we find the spirit of Messiah coming out of his mouth. Now, from a very young age, David's desire was always to do the will of God. And he was an amazingly godly young man. And so it was with Jesus. And so it is for us too, brethren and sisters. We might not be able to claim the title of very godly young men and women, but we have a desire to do God's will. But Jesus himself said, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom, but he that doeth the will of my Father that's in heaven. You know, it's easy to want to do the will of God, but it's a very different thing in practice. And it's through the circumstances that David got taken through, and the circumstances of our Lord's life, and the circumstances of our lives, brethren and sisters, the sufferings and the anguish, that he leads us to appreciate, like he did David and his own son, the value of obeying his will, of learning to surrender our will to his, And for us, brothers and sisters, through agony sometimes, through experiences that none of us like, we will cry to God with tears, "Thy will, not mine." That's where God wants to take us, brothers and sisters, not because he likes to see us suffer. He didn't like to see David suffer. And it wasn't a work of a moment, but God will take us all through a Gethsemane experience that he might elicit from our hearts that same cry. But we need not despair, because David passed through and the circumstances changed. Jesus passed through and finally was brought to life. Because God was using those experiences to shape and to prepare them for his kingdom. And it's no different in our lives. I'm going to sing a hymn at the end. A hymn that we probably know reasonably well, but it goes like this. When my love for God grows weak, when for larger faith I seek, then in thought I go to thee, Garden of Gethsemane. What does Gethsemane mean to you? What did it mean to David and to our Lord? But having gone there, brothers and sisters, the hymn goes on. Then to life I turn again, learning all the worth of pain, learning all the might that lies in a full self-sacrifice.